From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The rise of white supremacy in the U.S., going hand in hand with the election of Donald Trump, has left many Americans worried about short-term impacts on policy and society. But there's also a serious concern about the long-term ramifications of an emboldened movement that appears to be motivated by racial purity and white ethno-nationalism. U.S. history, and importantly European history, has much to teach us about how such movements evolve, what the distinctions are between groups and ideologies, and how even leftist ideology becomes part of fascist movements, how fascism takes political power. Exploring all of this is in a new book is my guest, Alexander Reed Ross. He's a lecturer at Portland State University and a freelance journalist and the editor of Grabbing Back, Essays Against the Global Land Grab. His new book, which came out in early 2017, is called Against the Fascist Creep. Welcome to the program, Alexander.
Thank you very much for having me, Sonali.
So let's get to defining a few terms before we go into some of the details in your book. When you say fascism, it's important for us to understand what that actually means. Some groups openly identify as fascist, even using the word fascist. But how do you explain to an American who might have only heard that term in the context of, you know, Spain and Italy decades ago, what fascism actually is?
That's an excellent and important question. I think fascism relies on mainly two central points, which are ultra-nationalism and the idea of a rebirth of a mythical past with this sort of new man that is going to destroy the corruption and structural disparities of the modern liberal state and forward this new revolutionary ultra-nationalist state wherein left-wing and right-wing sort of meet together in order to create a ethno-state nationalist empire, rather, that will have better implications for a specific set of people, the in-group, that specific nation, whether it's the Italians or the Germans or what have you.
So the idea of racial purity is important, the idea of nationalism, the nation state as a powerful empire, and then there's always a demagogue to promise the ushering in of the revolution to take them to that imagined place.
Well, it's an attempt to overcome the nation state, which is associated with the compromises of liberalism. And to create a new empire based on this historic, mythical, wonderful time in the past when patriarchy was central to the understanding of the world. And so patriarchy might be even more important than racial supremacy for a lot of fascists, or just in general within fascism, because if you look in the earliest forms of Italian fascism, they weren't necessarily always claiming to be racist, although they were strict imperialists, so they were de facto extremely racist. That's how you get fascism in places like Mexico or Brazil, right? Otherwise, it would be strictly relegated to Europe and white populations, which it's not.
What do you mean by the fascist creep? Some might resort to name calling Donald Trump as a fascist creep, but that's not what you're talking about here. What is the fascist creep?
Well, it's a sort of complicated issue. It's basically the way that fascism takes and maintains power. Fascist ideas and ideology are not entirely attractive to a majority of the population, regardless of whether or not the fascist movement is attempting to be populist. So what they tend to do is they tend to develop in and through right-wing populist movements or left-wing populist movements, and even the more sort of revolutionary ultra-left and ultra-right sects, in order to A, pit different political groups against one another so that they themselves can rise up, and then B, to co-opt those movements and then attempt to provide some sort of better platform through the insinuation of ethnic nationalism, and thereby appropriating the followers of left-wing groups and organizations. And this is done through the what's known as entryism, as a tactic of entering into left-wing or autonomous groups and social movements and attempting
infiltration, you mean?
Yes, it's infiltration. The term that is used, actually, interestingly enough, is entryism, which was originally used by Trotsky for the French section of the Workers' International. But it is a form of infiltration in order to take over, mislead, or completely destroy and dismantle left-wing groups. So that is one way that fascists sort of creep into the left and attempt to co-opt their constituents.
So here in the United States, it seemed to many Americans far-fetched that those people who might have gotten very attracted to Bernie Sanders' populism ended up voting for Donald Trump when Sanders ended up not being the Democratic nominee. But can you sort of explain that through the lens of how fascism works, that those people who might have left-leaning ideology, even if they're not in organized groups, end up picking somebody like a Trump because they see these movements echoing the same kind of language about populism and nationalism? Although, of course, Bernie Sanders wasn't a nationalist.
No, not at all. Not by any stretch of the imagination. However, for many workers, as Arun Gupta has shown in some of his articles,
he's one of our news correspondents, by the way.
Right. They're acting in their own self-interest in supporting Trump, or they thought that they were, because of his rhetoric, which was more economic protectionism and less sort of neoliberal outsourcing. And so they moved over to his sort of campaign, or rather movement, because of that in some ways. And if you look at the alt-right's rhetoric during that period, they were saying, we support, basic income, we support universal health care, at least Richard Spencer was saying this. And so basically they were saying, Bernie Sanders has a lot of really good platforms in terms of economic socialism. However, he's weak because he doesn't go towards the nationalist attitude. So socialism can't work unless it's a productivist, or rather producerist socialism, unless it's a socialism of hierarchies, of imperium, and of patriarchy. In other words, like the new man has to take the reins of socialism and lift everybody up instead of reducing everybody to a kind of common denominator that the far right associates with anti-racism and multiculturalism. And so you also have the left wing converging or colliding with this in the left's own critique of multiculturalism, for instance, as a capitalist phenomenon rather than a truly egalitarian effort. And so, the alt-right was using left-wing, and this is generally what fascists do, using left-wing positions and ideas in order to forward ultra-nationalist far-right ideas. And ultimately, the way the history shows is that they betray those left-wing ideas, cut out those followers after they've taken power, an attempt to develop some sort of archaic version of an empire.
And so do we see those lessons in elsewhere in our past, in Europe's past? Can you give us an example of how that has happened, where left-wing ideology has been co-opted to attract a broader base of support, only to then be abandoned once political power is achieved?
Well, I mean, it's difficult insofar as fascists haven't necessarily explicitly been elected to power or taken power, at least in the North Atlantic. We've seen a lot of authoritarian conservatives in recent years in, say, India or Turkey and Russia. Those are, or even one could say Brazil at this point. However, to call them those regimes fascist is a bit, out of line, I guess. At the same time, we have seen sort of radical right parties like the Front National and the FPO attaining a certain degree of power. And we haven't seen them in those situations actually implement the kind of economic agendas that they've been talking about. Instead, we've seen them really lean on a kind of security state, a lot of kind of snooping and a closed, what I guess one would call a closed society, a sort of movement towards totalitarianism. So yeah, that's a good question, and we should be leery of that. But at the same time, looking into history, you can just see the Nazis and the way that they treated the so-called Second Revolution and so-called left-wing faction of their movement in 1934, when in the Night of Long Knives they assassinated several of their leaders in order to consolidate power around the Hitler faction. So, I mean, that's the clearest example. But then you look to the original fascist movement in Italy, and they did something similar in terms of political positionality, where they were talking a lot of game about the national syndicalism, and then once they took power, they pretty much eradicated their syndicalist positions and consolidated power around corporatist almost a kind of national liberalism.
Do you see that infiltration you were talking about earlier, the entryism, right now here in the United States in a way that can be easily identifiable, where it's, groups and movements led by the Richard Spencers of America are trying to gain some entry point within left-wing movements here in the US?
The left in the US has woken up, at least the more radical elements of the left has woken up pretty well over the last couple of years especially. You still see far right and fascist groups insinuating themselves within the anti-imperialist movement, supporting Putin and Assad and claiming that this is any kind of regime that opposes the North Atlantic hegemony will be de facto a kind of anti-imperialist force.
And let's name names. I mean, can you name some of the organizations that take these positions?
Well, there are, I mean, if you look at, for example, direct participation in this kind of one of the leaders internationally is Alexander Dugin, and if he's Russian fascist, and if you look at participation in his sort of milieu, you have the World Workers' Party
The
associated.
Workers' World Party?
Workers' World Party associated groups involved in anti-imperialist organizing who have actually gone to these to at least one international forum with a number of secessionist far-right parties that are pro-Putin and collaborated. So that's one example in recent times, but you have to open up to also the libertarian movement and see a huge amount of infiltration there. And there's some crossover in terms of when you look at Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks crowd into the radical right sort of movement. as, you know, explained via this sort of anti-liberalism, effectively. The critique of liberalism as capitalist hegemony, and an actual promoter of inequality, has lent itself to cooperation between the far right and, in some cases, the far left. I think Assange's recent, or the recent revelations that Assange was literally trying to, and perhaps engaging in deliberately and openly, well, clandestinely engaging in cooperation with the Trump campaign, is one of the clearest examples, because so many leftists over the past few years have really hung their hats on WikiLeaks as the defender of, you know, free access to information throughout the world. So so that's a really obvious example there. And then you have other anti-imperialists in the actual Duganist sphere who, you know, are also sort of on the left, like Naveed Nasser, who really hates me and thinks that I'm a kind of proxy for Wasserman Schultz and stuff like that. So,
Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a leader of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, that's his nickname for me.
I'm assuming that you're critical of the Democratic Party establishment.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that they maintain a kind of elitist platform, and they haven't really adapted policies to appreciate the kind of inequality that has been increasing over the past 3 or 4 decades. So,
Alexander, in the last couple of minutes of our program, I definitely want to ask you what you make of Antifa, which has now sort of reached a mythical status nearly in the United States, especially since the events of Charlottesville, Virginia, where you have this sort of group of, in some cases, you know, ragtag black-clad folks who very explicitly say they're feminist, they're anti-patriarchal, they're anti-white supremacy, and unite sometimes themselves under the banner of Antifa, and other times are sort of labeled Antifa by others. Trump himself has identified them on his Twitter feed, and the radical so-called alt-right white supremacist groups here in the U.S. see them as symbolic of one of their main enemies. What do you make of Antifa? Are they as anti-fascist as the name suggests?
Well, they're definitely anti-fascists. And the problem is when the president's rhetoric and actions fuel hateful violence throughout the country, as the Southern Poverty Law Center has, you know, explained and exposed, direct action becomes the only form of confronting the problem and putting the hate down. And so Antifa groups are forming around the country because the political establishment is directly and deliberately fueling violence against the most vulnerable people in society. So I don't see necessarily what the problem is there. I just think that it's something, of course, that happens. It's a natural way for people to not only express dissent, but do something about people who are their friends, who are their family members, who are being attacked. And they're seeing the rise of hate crimes, and they're doing something about it. And in many cases, we're seeing the police actually relying on efforts online to expose the culprits of hate crimes. So in this case, you know, when the police aren't doing their job, when they're not fulfilling their role, who is going to? Right. And so I see it as a form of community defense. And honestly, I don't see anything wrong with that. And when you look at, for example, the kind of rhetoric that was used against anti-fascists at the beginning of the whole, you know, controversy with the Milo demonstrations in Berkeley, people were saying, you know, Milo is not a problem. He's not a fascist. He's not supportive of the fascist movement. He is just, you know, a controversialist who's, you know, against politically correct culture.
Controversialist. That's the first time I've heard that term. I like it. Go ahead.
And we've seen that completely disproven, right? Mm. He was really working with white nationalists with fascists to promote their movement through Breitbart, and Breitbart knew about it, and Steve Bannon was supporting Milo, and he was the president's chief strategist, and they're all funded by Mercer, who it turns out is profoundly influenced and supportive of the fascist movement, along with Peter Thiel, who's another rich billionaire that has been given, you know, a lot of respect and political clout by Donald Trump. So when you look at these figures, and there are so many others, Jeff Sessions and Chris Kobach, you know, when you look at these figures that Trump has brought into power, we are living in a kind of state that is fueling hate crimes, autonomous hate crimes, but also a regime of power that is actively oppressing people of color and immigrants, migrants. So, you know, what can you do about that? This is, you know, against everything we stand for. And so you have to do something, and that's what they're doing. So,
well, finally, Alexander, can knowing the history of fascism and how it plays out, the patterns it follows, help the U.S. today avoid the pitfalls of what had played out in Europe historically, what is currently playing out in Europe? Can we reverse the trend by knowing this history, by understanding the patterns and you know, stopping the fascist creep in its tracks?
I definitely think so. I think that the left for a long time has dismissed the threat of fascists sort of appropriating their talking points and basically cutting them out of the picture. The left has attempted at so many intervals to create a kind of populist movement inclusive of the right, and hasn't really been that awake to the risks of doing that. And while it's worked to some extent, we've seen it completely explode in our face. And I think that recognizing how this kind of thing happens, how it has played out in the past, will give us a real sense of how to strategize building popular movements and building political power without leaving ourselves open to this kind of attack.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you with the book.
Thank you very much, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
Alexander Reed Ross is a lecturer at Portland State University and a freelance journalist. He's the editor of Grabbing Back, Essays Against the Global Land Grab. And we've been discussing his new book, Against the Fascist Creep, which came out in early 2017. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.